and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, The Intercept reported over the weekend that the Ecuadorian government will imminently withdraw asylum for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Journalist Glenn Greenwald cites the presence in London of Ecuador's president, Lenin Moreno, ostensibly to speak at a conference on disabilities, saying the actual purpose of the trip is to finalize an agreement with the British government to expel Assange. While the government asserts that they won't remove him during Moreno's international trip, activists are in an intense state of mobilization. Next, President Trump last night issued a furious, all-capital letters tweet aimed at the Iranian government, warning that any threats against the United States would be met with dire consequences. The tirade signaled an immediate escalation in tensions between the two countries. Then, a new report on modern slavery around the world has found that the number of slaves in developed countries, including the United States, is much higher than previously thought. In its new report, the Walk Free Foundation says that there are 403,000 slaves in the United States. That's one in every 800 people and seven times higher than previously thought. And then today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, ISIS gunmen today stormed a government building in Erbil, the normally peaceful and heavily Kurdish city in northern Iraq, killing one civilian. Kurdish officials said that at least three gunmen were killed by security forces and that the siege is now over. What does this attack say about the stability of Iraq? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to London and Julian Assange. The Intercept reported over the weekend that the Ecuadorian government will imminently withdraw asylum for WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. Journalist Glenn Greenwald cites the presence in London of Ecuador's president Lenin Moreno, ostensibly to speak at a conference on disabilities, saying the actual purpose of the trip is to finalize an agreement with the British government to expel Julian. While the government asserts that they won't remove Assange during Moreno's international trip, that is, right now, activists are in an intense state of mobilization. We're joined from Berlin by activist and journalist Diani Barreto. Welcome, Diani.
Thank you for having me.
Diani, tell us how important this is. Is this just a rumor, or are you hearing that this is actually going to happen?
I have received information through various channels that this is indeed, everyone is on high alert, even their legal team and journalists and staff have been on high alert that not only is maybe the eviction imminent, but the whole team and even the legal team is likely to be targeted, which is unprecedented. Yes, and of course, the Ecuadorian government did release a press statement yesterday as he arrived in the UK to pretty much say, no, he will not discuss the topic of Assange and the asylum issue while he's in the UK or in Spain for this disabilities conference, as you mentioned, and that they're willing to still engage with his lawyers to find a solution to this. But that is a thinly veiled PR stunt, if you ask me, because there have been considerable mobilizations over the weekend from activists around the world on the internet trying to rally support across party and country lines to make some noise so the Ecuadorian government sees, no, this would not go well. It would be a PR disaster. But that being said, this is so odd that a country that asks for a legal opinion from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights on the rights of asylum and seeking asylum in embassies, it backfired. And they, of course, you know, pretty much say that Ecuador is in the obligation to protect him, that, yes, he does have rights to be there. So, I mean, I don't even know how legally, unless we've now completely lost and left the realm of law and the rule of law. This is what's very upsetting, because if he would to be evicted, he would be arrested by the UK authorities for these bail violations, which are maximum sentence perhaps of 3 months and a fine. You could say time served. It is a technicality. It's a political thing, obviously. Then he, of course, could be extradited to the US, which is setting a very, very dangerous precedent that would criminalize the publication of any secret documents or classified information, which the New York Times and the Washington Post, of course, does every day to some degree or another. So this is highly alarming. I'm very concerned that the mainstream media is not covering this other than just demonizing Julian Assange 24/7 and not seeing the merits of the public repository of knowledge that he has put forth, or WL as a team, searchable documents in a database of secret information, which in the public interest, it's a very alarming state. And I don't think this is to be taken lightly. I think it's very, 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 very grave.
Right. I mean, when you look at the sequence of events over the past several months, it's understandable to see why supporters of Julian Assange would be taking this very seriously and mobilizing, as Diani mentioned, in a series of online actions, going into a state of mobilization. Walk us through what's happened over the last few months, or maybe over the last year, that's put Julian Assange in such a precarious situation. You know, he's been in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for years, and he was relatively secure there, but that's changed in recent months, right?
Well, yeah, he's been there for 6 years, since 2012. It was a big deal for a small country to actually not pay heed to the U.S., the hegemon, and grant him asylum. And it was very painstakingly worded and argued by the former government of Korea and his foreign minister. And they have been amazing in terms of standing up to the pressures of the U.S. with trade sanctions and so forth. But then, of course, we have a new election and we have the new president, Lenin Moreno, literally just wants to overturn everything that Korea did in his administration. And one of those issues being, of course, the issue of Assange and the asylum that was granted. And there have been tensions with this administration and Assange, and pretty much they wanted to curtail his free speech and said, yes, he can continue publishing in the embassy, but he should not be commenting on the sovereign affairs of sovereign countries. And I think that was much more in relation to the Catalonian referendum and for independence. And apparently what set them off was that one tweet early in March, as Puigdemont was about to be extradited to Spain from Germany, about referencing a historic event in the past where the Nazi Germany had extradited the then Catalonian president and to meet his certain fate of firing squad. So that set off, of course, the Spanish government and applied pressure to the Ecuadorian government. And then, of course, he was incommunicado, and he has been incommunicado since, which no visits, no family members, no phone calls, no internet. It's literally isolation, and that is already unto itself. It would be, I think most prisoners have more rights than Julian Assange has in terms of visitation rights and sunshine and exercise and medical care and communications. So that's been happening. He's been incommunicado literally since then. They have been rather stalling. The Ecuadorian government has been stalling any kind of real form of, how should I say, negotiations. We should not criticize them too hardly because, of course, hopefully there is a speedy resolution to this maybe in the works. But again, it doesn't look like it because if everyone is on this high state of alert and their lawyers are also concerned for their own welfare, it's not boding well. So yeah, at this point, people need to speak up and journalists need to speak up because if this passes under this administration, it will legally criminalize every form of public oversight in matters of state. And I think that's what the mission of journalism is, and it would be anywhere. No one would be safe anywhere because they could be extradited or they could be criminalized in the U.S. or not protected under First Amendment freedoms.
We're speaking with Diani Barreto. She's an activist and journalist in Berlin. Diani, let's talk about worst case scenarios here. I think what we're not talking about is that Julian is expelled from the embassy and the British arrest him and charge him or try him for failure to appear, right? That's a minor, basically made up charge. It's a misdemeanor, no big deal. Is the worst case scenario that they arrest him and turn him over to the United States?
I would say so. I mean, it's with this administration, the Department of Justice Sessions said that it was a priority to arrest him. Pompeo has expressed publicly on several occasions that he's a non-state actor. I don't even know what that would mean in the States. Does that mean he goes, is he like an enemy combatant? Does that mean he would end up in Guantanamo if he's not supposed to enjoy civil liberty protections in the U.S.?
Well, that's a good question. That's a question that nobody's really answered here. Now, there are rumors that he has been secretly indicted in the Eastern District of Virginia, which is known colloquially as the Espionage Court. But you make a good point here. If he's deemed to be an enemy combatant, and he very well could be, that means he goes to Guantanamo. That means that he is not afforded access to an attorney. He has no civil rights. He has no legal rights of self-protection. I mean, that's a whole new world.
Yes, and that's very scary, of course. And that for a journalist, a publisher. So, that's what I'm concerned about, frankly.
We've got 2 minutes left. Tell us what people can do to help Julian or to make their voices known.
Please write the Ecuadorian Foreign Ministry in a peaceful and polite full tone and ask them to maintain and not retract the asylum that has been granted. That is a whole very important right. That write your congresspersons, your elected officials, write op-eds, write your newspapers, be active on Twitter and on Facebook and on social media. There's a Unity for J hashtag, and there is now a new digital army that was just founded over the weekend. Creative people, musicians of all walks of life. Everybody can do something, but we must speak up now.
You're absolutely right. Well, we were joined from Berlin by Diani Barreto. She is an activist and journalist. She's close to Julian Assange, and she's given us a very important update. Stay active. Make your opinions known about Julian and write to that foreign ministry in Ecuador. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
President Trump last night issued a furious all-capital letters tweet aimed at the Iranian government, warning that any threats against the United States would be met with dire consequences. The tirade signaled an immediate escalation in tensions between the two countries. We are joined from Sicily by Anne Wright. Anne is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became a prominent anti-war activist. Anne, welcome back.
Thank you, John and Walter. It's a pleasure to be with you all the way from Sicily.
You're doing some important work out there, and we're going to ask you about that at the end of this segment. But first, try to help us make sense of this tweet. Why this harsh tweet, and why now?
It is a little confusing here. To my knowledge, the Iranian government has never threatened the United States. I mean, there have been harsh words, certainly as with the North Korean government. There are harsh words that have been back and forth, but to my knowledge, the Iranian government has never threatened the United States. And for, I think Trump needs a diversion, as always. He needs a diversion from all of the stuff that's going around about the investigation on contacts with Russians before the election. He needs a diversion from all of the domestic things that are starting to level to the surface, and his own base is being very, very inquisitive about what is going on here, where farmers in the Midwest who voted for him are now getting really hammered by all the trade war on agricultural products. So I think Trump is doing one of his classic moves, which is trying to divert attention from what's going on. But he's really playing with fire on this one. I mean, not that I in any way think that the Iranian government would ever, just like I don't think the North Korean government would ever think about attacking the United States, because they know the might of the U.S. and they know that the U.S. uses its might in some horrible fashion. The number of countries that have been attacked by the United States. So for the Iranian government to invite an attack by threatening the United States is highly improbable.
Let me read this tweet for our listeners, too. He says, quote, "To Iranian President Rouhani," and then he begins all capital letters, "never, ever threaten the United States again, or you will suffer consequences the likes of which few throughout history have ever suffered before. We are no longer a country that will stand for your demented words of violence and death. Be cautious." Rouhani did respond, actually, and said that When you play with the lion's tail, you will regret it eternally, he said. Now, it seems to me, and tell me if I'm wrong, Anne, this is just kind of a meaningless posturing between these two. And Trump issued the tweet in response to a comment that Rouhani made saying that that any American war with Iran would be the mother of all wars. But is there anything else behind this? Is there anything that we ought to be worried about, or is it just posturing?
Well, we certainly ought to be worried about this. I think we've heard the term mother of all wars before, and that was on the Iraq issue. And under Bush, they used the false information of weapons of mass destruction to justify the invasion and occupation, the invasion, destruction, and occupation of Iraq. So we need to be worried about these things because U.S. presidents certainly have destroyed other countries and on false circumstances. We certainly know that the Vietnam War was based on false circumstances. The invasion and occupation of Iraq, the invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, it wasn't to go after Al-Qaeda. I mean, Al-Qaeda was chump change by going to Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda. So we do need to be worried about it, worried that yet one more American president is willing to kill hundreds of thousands of people in another part of the world and in a culture that is, I would say, what is it, like 15 times older than the United States, the little child nation of the United States. It's 240 years old, and yet Persian culture goes back 4,000 years. So destruction of another culture, just like we destroyed Iraq and the unbelievable and irreplaceable history of Iraq in ruins because of what the United States did, and the same thing going on in Syria right now.
Mike Pompeo gave a speech over the weekend, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, saying that, well, basically he was speaking to an audience of Iranian Americans who are opponents of the current Iranian government, basically saying we are for regime change, you know, like a full-threaded endorsement of regime change, as these economic sanctions that the Trump administration has been playing up a lot in recent weeks and really beginning to enforce on a significant and global scale begins to kick in. Mike Pompeo's speech was called Supporting Iranian Voices, which is, you know, would be quite a turnaround for U.S. government policy towards Iran. Certainly when democratically elected Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh was overthrown in 1953, the weight of Iranian voices didn't weigh too heavily in the minds of U.S. policymakers. But it seems like there's echoes of something that, you know, caused you to resign from the U.S. State Department, the Iraq War, where there's this internal or external, really, opposition that's cultivated that can be sort of parachuted into the country in the event that the United States is able to effect regime change. Do you think that's what's happening? Do you think that's what Pompeo's speech yesterday was about?
Well, it certainly is reminiscent of the Project for the New American Century, which is the Republican roadmap to the destruction of 10 different governments. I may be wrong on 10, but a lot of governments. And then the Bush administration's axis of evil, Iran, Iraq, North Korea. It is very reminiscent of it. And that regime, you know, the Obama administration at least said regime change is not what we're after, although they did do regime change. This is a blatant, obvious, clear message that the United States is going to continue to, and we have been. I mean, we've been spending over $100 million every single year that's allocated by the Congress for regime change in countries. And there are things that happen in Iran, as they did in Iraq, as they've done, to my knowledge, not in North Korea, because the North Koreans have such a good security state that I don't think U.S. Operatives or paid U.S. operatives are able to do much against the government there. But certainly in Iraq, Iran, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, the U.S. has used its $100 million a year in ways that have undercut elected governments as well as gone after dictatorships. Pompeo is just putting the cards on the table, saying regime change is yet again one of the policies of the United States. And I think that's one of the reasons that probably Rouhani made his response, that it'll be a cold day in hell before the Iranian people will allow the United States to overthrow that government, although there are plenty of Iranians that don't like the revolutionary government it has been brutal to certain segments of the country. There are a lot of people, a lot of Iranians that do want a change in the government, but they've seen what happens when it's the United States that comes in with its military and destroys the governmental institutions, brings in the shills of the opposition, like Ahmed Chalabi attempted to be to come in to run the Iraq government, but he was demoted, and we put in a proconsul, Paul Bremer, for over a year. Paul Bremer ruled Iraq, and during that time, he destroyed the institutions that could have laid the groundwork for something, but instead, the generals were thrown out, the bureaucracy was thrown out, and chaos reigned. And those who were thrown out of government then became part of the opposition to the government that was installed by the United States, and the Civil War erupted there through that. So it sounds like we're doing a repeat performance on sending the signals of regime change, and one ought to expect that the Iranian leadership are going to respond to these direct threats from the United States.
And we've got about 30 seconds left. Tell us why you're in Sicily.
I'm here with the 2018 Gaza Freedom Flotilla. We have just sent off, after 75 days of traveling around Europe, having educational events in over 28 ports, we've just sent 3 out of 4 of the boats that will be a part of the flotilla. They are now headed from Sicily, headed to Gaza. They'll be approaching Gaza in about 8.5 days, and purpose is to break the illegal Israeli blockade of Gaza.
We will leave it there. We were joined from Sicily by Ann Wright. Ann is a retired U.S. Army colonel and former U.S. State Department official in Afghanistan who resigned in protest of the invasion of Iraq and became an anti-war activist. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
A new report on modern slavery around the world has found that the number of slaves in developed countries, including the United States, is much higher than previously thought. In its new report, the Walk Free Foundation says that there are 403,000 slaves in the United States. That's 1 in every 800 people, and 7 times higher than previously thought. We're joined from New York by Leah Obias. They're with the Damayan Migrant Workers Association, a grassroots organization of low-wage Filipino workers. And we're joined from New York by Edith Mendoza, a survivor of trafficking and modern-day slavery, who is also an organizer for Damayan. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi.
Leah, let's start with you. Slavery was supposed to be a thing of the past. And to be perfectly honest with you, I had no idea that the numbers were so high, especially in the United States and other Western countries. Tell us what modern day slavery actually looks like.
Sure. Well, we know from our community's experience that rather than being a thing of the past, that slavery never really ended. It merely assumed different legalized forms, such as mass incarceration in the United States. And currently, modern-day slavery is a defining feature, really, of the current immigration regime. So people often are surprised by these numbers or ask, how can this happen? But it's really more accurate to think that and ask, how can this not happen, given the fact that the root causes of the forced displacement and migration of people from their homelands in order to seek livelihood abroad really are the same forces that cause modern-day slavery. So the fact that we have not addressed these root causes means that slavery continues and will continue in the future. So in the Philippine experience, these root causes include the legacy of colonialism and the continued subjugation of the Philippine economy and society to the interests of wealthy multinational corporations and political elite. And massive unemployment continues in the Philippines, as well as backward labor policies that are really exacerbated by the current regime under Rodrigo Duterte. So one of these backwards labor policies is the policy of labor export, which has intensified. To this day, there are still over 4,000 Filipinos leaving the Philippines every day, according to official statistics. But we know that the number is much higher and approaches even 5,000 or 6,000. We know that the economy really depends on remittances from overseas Filipino workers, and that number, the global remittances, is approaching $30 billion now, which is an incredible dependence on the labor and the money that Filipino workers send home to the Philippines. And so in addition to those conditions in the Philippines, the creation of exploitative visa programs here in the United States, like the H-2A and H-2B agricultural and guest worker programs, the A-3 and G-5 visa programs for domestic workers of diplomats, and the J-1 program, which is supposedly for training and education, to name a few of these visa programs, really cause widespread exploitation in the United States. And so those factors internationally, like, again, in the Philippine experience through labor export and massive unemployment, along with these visa programs created by the United States, really work together like a hand and a glove, really, to create the conditions that cause slavery. So what it looks like is that there's, of course, widespread exploitation in a variety of low-wage industries, including domestic work, service work, like hotel and restaurants, and really a variety of industries, factory work across the United States, where those visa programs that I mentioned recruit workers.
Edith, let's turn to you. You're an organizer with the Damayan Migrant Workers Association. Tell us how you became connected to that organization, what led you to become an organizer, and what can be done to fight back against this problem? I mean, it's such a huge problem, like Leah laid out, and the oppression is so terrible, but we shouldn't feel helpless, right? I mean, there are many things that people are actively doing to fight back.
Yeah, as a trafficking survivor, through organizing in Damayan, I found my passion as well as self-respect and dignity serving the people. I understood the economic and social forces that compelled me to leave my own children to work abroad, whereas other workers happened to, as what Leah said a while ago. And I learned why many domestic workers like me become victims of labor trafficking and modern-day slavery by the abusers. So this gave me purpose to workers to stand fight back against the traffickers and modern-day slavery that the survivors and workers, immigrants, have health coverage and family separation. So my experience impacted me as what I have been through with my traffickers, diplomats, when I was with them, that I've been working with them 80 to 100 hours a week. So I've been working with 1.5 years every single day with the diplomats. So I had to wake up very early at 6 o'clock and work straight sometimes until 1 a.m. So I also did the laundry, iron and everything, house chores in the house. Aside from the nanny work, I've been taking care for 4 boys under 11 and 1.5 years old. So I also did the old house chores. I did all those by myself, so it's hard for me. And aside from those, I did much harder work outside the house as a car washer, shoveling the snow, I mean, for 2 cars' driveways during the winter time without any proper jackets or boots or gloves. And I scrub and wash the house perimeter fences in summertime. So, and then I had to carry pails and water back and forth. So it seems that my body is falling apart. My body was affected so much. So I did not have proper heating and cooling in my room as well. So my health deteriorated, and I still feel that impact of that today. So, you know, I had a feeling of dizziness. My eyes got blurry, and I felt that I would collapse. Until now, I have that every time I triggered my body.
Edith, how did that happen to you? How did you find yourself sucked into this terrible experience?
Yeah, so when I found out that, you know, I have been violated the contract that I have been signed, you know, because my health was deteriorated, so I have to look for help. So I found Damayan. So Damayan helped me find an access to connect to some services like lawyers. So So when I have to knew my rights to the Mayan by learning my human rights, I have to go under file the case. You know, the impact of that experience towards my experiences is empowered me to work with the organizing in the Mayan.
Leah, you know, Edith is talking about her experience with a diplomat, with enslavement as it relates to domestic work. What are some of the other sectors of the economy where modern day slavery is prevalent, and why is it prevalent in those particular areas of the economy?
Sure, as I mentioned, the other visa programs like the H-2A and H-2B, the agricultural, certainly there's strong organizing work going on in the particularly farm worker sector that has exposed slavery happening in farm fields in Florida and other parts of the United States. So certainly the agricultural industry, which is heavily reliant on immigrant labor, but also through the guest worker programs where in the hotel and restaurant industries particularly, but also in factories where guest workers are, frequently, finding work where they're recruited. Those are the visa programs that were created, in fact, by the United States and really are rife with exploitation caused in large part because the workers are temporary, where they don't have access to a clear path to legalization as workers here in the United States, where their status is tied to their employers and where really the terms of their employment are dictated and controlled by employers and recruiters, and where a lot of the agencies that recruit workers really escape a lot of accountability by the U.S. government.
Leah, tell us also why the numbers are so much higher than they've been in previous reports. Was there a different methodology, or is this this problem growing increasingly bad?
I think certainly the problem is growing increasingly bad, again, because, as I mentioned, the root causes that cause the forced displacement of people really has not been addressed. And so global migration continues to increase, particularly to wealthy countries like the United States, which really is a country that continues to set up migration policies in terms of bringing in international migrants to work in low-wage jobs in those industries that I mentioned before. So global migration usually flows towards the direction of capital, and so the United States is one of the largest, if not the largest, receiving country of international migrants to find work. And yet, as we know, the incredibly repressive immigration regime here in the United States continues to cause exploitation.
We were joined from New York by Leah Tobias. They are with Damayan Migrant Workers Association, a grassroots organization of low-wage Filipino workers. And we were also joined from New York by Edith Mendoza, a survivor of trafficking and modern-day slavery, who is also an organizer for Damayan. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We have a lot more.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, where we look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Today we're joined from Bothell, Washington, by Dr. Wayne Au. He's a professor in the School of Educational Studies at the University of Washington at Bothell and a longtime author and editor of the social justice teaching magazine Rethinking Education. Dr. Au, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
I was looking at an interview that you gave just recently. It was published on July 10th at the Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting website, in which you talk about this massive anti-democratic model of education reform. Can you tell us what that's about?
Yeah, what we're seeing and what we have been seeing, going back at least to two or three, going back to the Bush administration, even, and carrying on through Obama and, of course, obviously under Trump, has been a real ramping up of sort of the application of like free market capitalism to how policymakers think about education policy, right? And so this is a sort of massive sort of top-down, corporate-led framing of, you know, schools as places that are best served by, you know, producing profit and financialization, treating kids like products, treating schools like businesses, and sort of making it all sort of a big competition, you know, where the losers fail and the winners succeed. And so really, really sort of, I would say, anti-human and very detrimental to kids and teachers and schools and communities.
Yeah, this turned towards the corporatization of education, whether that means outright privatization, whether it means, you know, charterization, which, you know, if you ask me, is sort of a stepping stone on the way to full privatization, or just the introduction of standardized testing and other sort of, you know, like you said, you know, like anti-humanist measures in education. It's taking place all across the country, but it's taking place at different speeds in different localities. I mean, there are certain cities, Philadelphia and New Orleans are one that come to mind, where this process of corporatization is especially, very profoundly developed, I think. Talk about sort of the class nature, the racial nature of where this school, quote unquote, reform program is being implemented.
Yeah. It's the thing about these reforms, right? So they're all built on testing, and essentially test scores become, you know, the proxy for failure and success. But because test scores correlate so strongly with like race and class, right? Then what happens is that all these working class Black and Brown communities become the focal point for all these reform efforts. And so you see charters happening, you know, right in working class Black and Brown communities, and Teach for America and, you know, more testing in those communities. Right. And so what happens then is like, you see, get places like New Orleans where, that became this sort of, you know, after Katrina became this hotbed of like, you know, it became the space where they basically blew up the teachers union, had, you know, tens of thousands of Black teachers were let go. And then they're basically experimenting on all these Black and Brown kids, right? They're going to do hyper-charterization, these hyper-disciplinary charter schools, essentially the whole push to privatize and sort of make money off of public education ends up being focused in those communities too. And the greatest irony, of course, is that testing, charter schools, all these reforms get advanced in the name of like racial equality, when if you really look at the research on all this stuff, you know, it's having all these reforms are having sort of a hyper detrimental impact on Black and Brown kids across the country. It's just, it's impacting the quality of education so greatly. And really, you know, to my mind, like when you look at how the tests get used, how the charters get used, you get this whole thing where I sort of see a really strong connection between like these kinds of reforms and even the schools to prison pipeline, right? Because I think you're preparing these kids to be, you know, in these hyperdisciplinary charters, for instance, they're basically being prepared to like move right up into the system if they get booted out or if they don't graduate high school. It's really terrible.
And Dr. Au, a lot of your work focuses on how injustices like these or, you know, other racial, economic, so on, injustices in society are taught about in schools and how young people learn about them. So clearly the process of charterization, corporatization is detrimental to, you know, the adequate teaching of about social issues. But tell us a little bit more about your work, your theories about how education can be used as sort of a launching pad for students to be active participants in their society.
Yeah, for sure. I think, you know, historically education has served, you know, a sort of a broadly oppressive function in this country in terms of maintaining race and class and other sort of hierarchies and power relations. But, you know, education during this whole time, education has always also been, schools have always been spaces of a lot of liberatory, like really potential liberatory practices and sort of like places where we can grow and make them hotbeds of like critical consciousness. And that's, to me, is the key. And so there's all kind of work that we can be doing. I know, you know, here in Seattle, and it's picked up nationally, we had a real big victory in the last couple of years where we did Black Lives Matter at school, and we had huge campaigns where we were teaching students, you know, about Black history, about police brutality, you know, about the prison abolition movement, talking about restorative justice, talking about ethnic studies and Black studies, and how that kind of how like students, communities, and cultures and histories need to be ramped up in the curriculum. And so we have a space within schools then, if we push it in these directions, so that students can start to see themselves as like powerful activists and really, really just like active, you know, active participants, active movers and shakers in society in ways that can push for justice, push against, you know, institutionalized racism, push against, class inequality, and especially places like here in Seattle where things are so disparate right now. We can use curriculum as a way to get students to have like these big systemic meta understandings of what's going on and, you know, why the gentrification is going on and how folks are getting kicked out of their communities and homes, and like help them, you know, arm them with the right kind of knowledge to help them sort of be in a position to say, hey, I want to try and fix this. I want to go out and stop this. Let's start organizing and let's start pushing back against these inequalities.
Dr. Au, you are the co-author of a recent book called Teaching for Black Lives. I'd like to read a paragraph from the introduction. I think it's so impactful. And then I want you to comment on it and why you think a book like this is so important right now in 2018. Here's a paragraph from the introduction. 15-year-old black student Kobe Burin was in a geography class at Pearland High School near Houston in the fall of 2015. As he read the assigned page of his textbook, he noticed something that deeply disturbed him. A map of the United States with a caption that said the Atlantic slave trade brought, quote, millions of workers from Africa to the southern United States to work on agricultural plantations, unquote. Kobe took a picture of his textbook and texted it to his mother, adding, "We was real hard workers, wasn't we?" along with a sarcastic emoji. Not only had the McGraw-Hill textbook replaced the word slave with workers, they also placed the chapter on the enslavement of Africans in the chapter of the book entitled Patterns of Immigration, as if Africans came to the United States looking for a better life. I think that's so dramatic, and it exemplifies such ignorance that we have in current textbooks in many of our public schools that it almost defies understanding. Talk about this book.
Yeah, so Teaching for Black Lives just came out earlier this spring of this year. It's a book I co-edited with Diane Watson and Jesse Agopian, also we're all editors at Rethinking Schools. And really, we put this book out there because, we're in a historical moment. We have this opportunity, right, where we have gained traction around Teaching for Black Lives, around Black Lives Matter at school, that there are these grassroots movements happening in schools and in communities to educate kids about this stuff. And so we're in this moment where we have the space to go ahead and start talking really strongly about how do we teach Black history in ways that don't lie about the past and don't play these games like with McGraw-Hill around how are they going to frame the enslavement of Africans, right? And how are they going to whitewash slavery and chattel slavery and this extreme exploitation of black bodies, right? And so for us, this book, Teaching for Black Lives, then is it really a tool for community educators, for parents, for school teachers, to really, sort of go after like, at the heart of the Black Lives Matter movement is to us, at least, is the humanization of black people. Right. And so what does it mean to do that in the classroom? Right. Whether it's how we teach history, how we teach about self-love and identity. And then also how we also understand, white supremacy and how that operates in and through schools, through police, through institutions in this country, and really, help students get to a spot where they're like, hey, I not only do I understand myself better, I understand my community better, and I feel like I'm going to go ahead and really begin to fight for a more just world. And so we really see this book as a tool to sort of go in that direction and really, really show the power of possibility of education.
Dr. Au, we have under a minute left, but to the extent that this is happening in schools, that the true history and empowering history, as well as the history of the deep injustices that have been committed throughout U.S. history, are being taught accurately. It's through the initiative of teachers themselves, through education workers. For instance, I know in Philadelphia, the Caucus of Working Educators, a group within the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers, was instrumental in pushing the Teaching for Black Lives or the Black Lives Matter Week at schools. Just talk about that worker protagonism in the last 30 seconds.
Oh yeah, I mean between but basically what we're seeing in several cities are really core left groups within the unions, for instance, pushing the unions left and organizing teachers and kind of helping them see the power that they actually have when they get together and when they push not just for curricular reforms but policy reforms and not just bread and butter stuff in terms of like contracts, but like how do we think about community and racial justice as part of our organizing work as teachers and as labor? And we're seeing that going on in multiple cities across the country. And hopefully, even with the red state strikes, we're seeing the kernel of that consciousness growing in some of those spaces as well.
That was the voice of Dr. Wayne Au. He joined us from Bothell, Washington. He's a professor in the School of Educational Studies at the University of Washington at Bothell and a longtime author and editor of the social justice teaching magazine Rethinking Education. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
ISIS gunmen today stormed a government building in Erbil, the normally peaceful and heavily Kurdish city in northern Iraq, killing one civilian. Kurdish officials said that at least three gunmen were killed by security forces and that the siege is now over. What does this attack say about the stability of the country? We're joined from Washington by Kani Zulam. He's the founder of the American Kurdish Information Network. Kani, it's good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Kani, what do you make of this attack? Was this an anomaly, or is this something that the residents of northern Iraq should be worried about?
I think they should be worried about. These three youngsters, one 18, the other two 16-year-olds, apparently are locals. There is a video of them now on the internet. They have, when you look at the way they have dressed, is very conservative, with beards, the 18-year-old at least. And I mean, it speaks ill of the Kurdish government in terms of not knowing that, you know, there were ISIS sleeping cells in its midst. It also speaks ill of the government of Iraq that it still hasn't been able to get rid of this menace, that ISIS is there underground and can strike at will. This is bad news for Kurdistan regional government, and it's bad news for Iraq in general.
Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi, he's declared victory in the war against ISIS. I mean, he said it's effectively over, or he said it is over. You know, there have been a number of terrorist attacks carried out by ISIS in Iraq since then. But, you know, the narrative, I think, coming from the government is these are just sort of the very last remaining elements. You know, there are a certain number of sleeper cells, but this isn't indicative of a broader trend. But the fact that this attack today happened in Erbil, you know, like John mentioned in the introduction, you know, a normally, you know, peaceful city, certainly compared to many other parts of Iraq. The fact that an attack happened here, does that make you concerned that this is perhaps part of a trend whereby ISIS, you know, may be able to survive for quite some time in a diminished state?
In terms of Iraq, people's concerns need to be met before you could get rid of groups like this. There are grievances on the part of the Sunni minority that they're not part of the government, that it's dominated by Shiites, at least in Iraq proper, in the Arab parts of Iraq. But this last month has also seen, you know, protests in Basra, in other Arab cities in Iraq. People, even Shiites, not being very happy with the government, that the government is not really transparent, is not really accountable, is not really providing services, basic, you know, electricity, basic human services that come with living in a city. So it's, I would think that we will have a period of instability. The elections didn't produce clear winners. You know, basically a bunch of parties divided the votes, and there isn't still a government. Abadi is in charge, but Sadr's party has the majority votes. It's ever since Saddam was toppled in 2003, Iraq has yet to find its footing, has yet to, you know, act like a state and provide basic services to its citizens. And I don't think we're coming to the end of this. I think there's more instability to come.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, come on, ISIS, you know, it's only been around for a couple of years. You know, how can you blame that on the United States invasion? But I think there's a very direct line from the U.S. 2003 invasion of Iraq to the creation of ISIS itself. And, you know, one of the very early decisions that the U.S. occupation authorities made was to institute a policy that they called de-Ba'athification, meaning that people who had been affiliated in one way or another with the former ruling party, the Ba'ath Party of Saddam Hussein, would be, you know, blacklisted from many, many different facets of public life. They disbanded the Iraqi army as well. And so there was an influx or, you know, an outpouring, I suppose, from the army of young people who have, you know, very few economic prospects, who are also, you know, proficient in different military training. You know, in other words, it was sort of this colonial arrogance, blunder after blunder after blunder, that created the conditions and the sectarian atmosphere where an organization like ISIS could emerge. Do you see it that way? And is that problem of sectarianism in Iraqi society part of the reason that we see attacks like we did, you know, today in Erbil?
Well, I'll say two things. One is, you know, the people who were part of the Ba'ath Party didn't really have a choice. Saddam was running the country with an iron fist. And, you know, you either joined the Ba'ath Party and protected your family and had a salary and, you know, had a semblance of a living in a functioning society, so to speak, even though Iraq as a whole, you know, was not democratic, was not free. That's one thing. The other thing is there are, Iraq as a whole, I would say, is not a natural state. There are, within the Arabs, you have the Sunni Shiite factionalism, and then you have, in addition to that, you have the Kurdish Arab factionalism. The Kurds from the get-go weren't happy to be part of this experiment called Iraq that was, you know, basically created by Great Britain, and it's still kept together. When ISIS emerged in 2014 and 2012, and then attacked Iraq in 2014 and took over Mosul and a bunch of other cities, you know, they posted a video on the internet that they ended the Sykes-Picot borders forever. They haven't been erased forever. Iraq is still there. Syria is still there. But they addressed an issue that, you know, these borders were put there not by themselves, not by locals, not by the Arabs who live there or the Kurds who live there, but by the imperial powers that came there. And those divisions are still with us. You know, the there are tribes who live both in Iraq and also in Syria, and there are Kurds who live in, you know, not just in Iraq, but also in Syria and also in Turkey and also in Iran. And I think, you know, people in this day and age, you know, would like to being able to travel at will, being able to do commerce at will, but we're not there yet.
Tell us about the progress that Iraq has made in the last couple of years on these issues. Is it getting any better? Is there really progress?
Well, I would say if you were to ask your average Arab in Iraq or in your average Kurd in Kurdistan Regional Government area, would you like to have Saddam Hussein back? My hunch is most would say, no, I don't want Saddam Hussein back. I like my freedoms. I like my, you know, I'm able to access more news. But they would also add that, you know, there's no stability, there's no functioning government, there's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of nepotism, there's a lot of, you know, there's no transparency. So there's progress in terms of people vote, at least. There's progress, at least there's more news outlets, but there's no progress in terms of stability, that which is the essence of a government for its citizens, to protect them, to technically, you know, increase their happiness, if you will.
We're talking with Kani Zulam. He's the founder of the American Kurdish Information Network, about an attack in Erbil, a heavily Kurdish city in the Kurdistan Regional Government of Iraq, where ISIS gunmen carried out an attack. Kani, this attack comes at an extremely tense time in Iraqi politics, whereby the you know, there was an election, I believe in May. There was, you know, many, many parties that ran, so no one party got a majority. And there's this complex negotiations, you know, going on and have been going on for quite some time. And on top of all of that, there's a total recount of all the ballots that have been ordered and is yet to be carried out. And so, you know, that may reconfigure the parliament and subsequently the negotiations. You know, there are many Kurdish parties. You know, I believe Erbil is the stronghold of the Kurdistan Democratic Party. How would these types of attacks, you know, let's say that ISIS really isn't quite as defeated as we might have thought, how would these attacks affect this tense political situation?
You would think that they would nudge the talking heads in Baghdad and in Erbil to close ranks and then to address the issues of security and economy. But it could be that because, for example, the Kurdish experiment in self-rule backfired. Iraq used its army to take control of Kirkuk. Before the city was taken over, the city had 12 deputies in the parliament in Baghdad, eight of whom were Kurds, two were Arabs, and two were Turkmen, which basically speaks to the demographics of the city. But after the city was taken over, there were the elections in last May, and now the election results are that there are 6 Kurdish deputies, 3 Arab deputies, and 3 Turkmen deputies. It's not that a lot of Turkmens moved into the city or a lot of Arabs moved into the city. A lot of Kurds felt unsafe and left the city, and so the demographics changed. So this is a country that has a problem like that. People don't feel safe, let's say in the government region, and I'm talking about Kurds now, or they feel like their rights are not secure. And you still have the issue of oil. You still have the factionalism that's in Baghdad. And you would think that they would get together and say Iraq has enough wealth for all of us. Let's share it, let's enjoy it, but it doesn't have enough for the greed of the people in the ruling circles, and you have the perpetual problem that Iraq is, a dysfunctional state as we speak.
Well, that was the voice of Kani Zulam. Kani is the founder of the American Kurdish Information Network. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.